All right, let's call this meeting of the Senate State Affairs Committee to order. Let the record reflect that it is 3:30 p.m. on Tuesday, February 20th. Let the record also reflect that we have a quorum present today, our Vice Chair Coghill, Senator Costello, Senator Kawasaki, and myself, Chairman Rivak. Staffing the committee today is the amazing Ms. Cooper Ryder and Mr. Williams and Ms. Tangeman, my committee aide. Please silence your cell phones. Thank you. Today we have several items on the agenda. First, we are going to consider the four governor's appointees for the Alaska Police Standards Council. And after that, we'll hear SB 169, License Plates, Council on the Arts, sponsored by Senator Stevens. And lastly, excuse me, we'll have a second hearing on SB 167, Aggregating Factor Corrections Officer, which we hope to move out of committee today. All right, we will jump right into our appointees to the Alaska Police Standards Council. The mission of APSC is to produce and maintain a highly trained and positively motivated professional capable of meeting contemporary law enforcement standards and performance. And I'd like to also note that Senator Wilson is here present today. Up first, we have Chief Ed Mercer of the Juneau Police Department. Chief Mercer, are you on the line? If so, could you please put yourself on the record and tell us a little bit about yourself and how you relate to this position?
Thank you, Mr. Chair, and thank you to other committee members. My name is Ed Mercer. I am currently the Chief of Police for the Juneau Police Department. I was born and raised in Sitka, Alaska, and I appreciate the opportunity today to testify to be considered to serve on the Alaska Police Standards Council Board. I've been a law enforcement officer for 27 years, starting my career at the Sitka Police Department in 1992. I then transferred to the Juneau Police Department in 2000. During my tenure with JPD, I have had many opportunities to advance in my career, working my way through the rank from officer to chief. I have attended thousands of hours of police training during the course of my career that have included basic police procedures to more advanced supervision, management, and executive level command schools. I hold a Bachelor of Science degree in Criminal Justice from Herzing University in Madison, Wisconsin, and I'm a graduate of the FBI National Academy. I currently serve as a Vice Chair on the Alaska Association of Chiefs of Police Board. I also serve on the FBI Criminal Justice Information Northwest Group Board, and also the Vice Chair for the Alaska High Intensity Drug Trafficking Area Board. I also served locally on our local emergency planning committee and our local homeless task force. I want to serve on the APSC board because I have a strong purpose to serve. I have a good understanding of the police professionalism and accountability, and I believe my experiences, I could share that with other board members on the council. I'm a critical thinker and methodical in decision making that I think will be helpful on serving on this board. I have a strong desire to keep our law enforcement profession credible by having uniform standards for all Alaska LEO. Again, I can't stress it more, accountability is essential in our profession. Police departments need a system of internal checks and balances to make sure their personnel are following through with their duties properly and act with integrity. Thank you for the opportunity for my opening statement, and I'm available for questions, Mr. Chair.
Thank you, Chief Mercer. Do we have any questions from committee members? Yes, Senator Coghill.
Ed, thanks for being willing to serve on this. You have been able to see some of the career changes down through the years. What do you expect that are some of the issues that will rise up with some of the changing generations that you see accountability is now more important than ever?
Well, through the chair, thank you, Senator Coghill. Obviously, we're always having challenges with generational changes in that mindset. I don't necessarily see any significant challenges when it comes to the commitment. However, saying that, commitment and staying long-term in our profession is farther out. I mean, as far as somebody finishing their career after 25 years, that is certainly a concern that I think all police departments are going to have to deal with as we move forward.
A follow-up.
Thank you. And I know that was an open-ended question, and it wasn't meant to put the new generation in any worse light. It's just that there are generational changes, and I think you probably hit on one of them, and that is retention. As we go through this, I know we have higher standards and retention needs. I know that there's going to be some pressure on the integrity issue. So I just thought, from your perspective, how do we balance that discussion?
Through the chair, Senator Coggle, good question. I think we maintain that by outlining strong expectations and professionalism in our career by having a council that sets standards, minimum standards for all law enforcement officers in the state of Alaska. And with that, certainly broadens that perspective of how important it is for serving as a law enforcement officer in the state of Alaska. So I think we do that as far as providing adequate training, having our officers go through academy and showing them the ins and outs of law enforcement. But and really, quite honestly, the oath that an officer takes when they accept a job as a police officer is very big as far as understanding that this is a very important job, and people are putting a lot of expectation in your decision making and how you uphold what you're representing in a law enforcement capacity.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. Good point, and I just thought with his experience, he's going to not only serve well, but he brings a long perspective in that. And so for that, I'm grateful that you're willing to serve. I appreciate it, Ed.
Thank you, Senator Coghill. Senator Kawasaki.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. Thank you for putting your name forward and wanting to serve on this important council. We're looking at a bill here in the legislature dealing with increasing the standards for peace officers and a redefinition of peace officers to include village police officers and village public safety officers. I'm curious to hear your comments on that, and then I'll have a follow-up.
Through the chair, Senator Kowalski, thank you for the question. I am familiar with the bill. I believe we're talking about SB 164 and House Bill 224 as far as adding village police officers to the bill. I think it's essential in the integrity of our profession to assure that all people who are enforcing laws in the state of Alaska go through the necessary standards that are applied, and as far as having the background in law enforcement to assure to the public that we are doing the best we can in our profession and doing the right thing when we are enforcing laws.
Follow-up?
Just a quick follow-up, and I agree. I think, you know, we definitely need to have a high standard for public servants who wear a badge. I think the public deserves that confidence in the system. I do have a question because you've worked in the Sitka Police Department, and I'm not sure if you, like, it's a small department, remote parts of Alaska that only have a village police officer or only have a VPSO presence often can't find the most qualified people, or they have a very small pool. And I'd like to hear your comments about how the state would be able to help communities like that in very, very remote parts of Alaska to find the best applicants, the qualified applicants, and the people that have the highest standards.
Through the chair, Senator Kowalski, thank you for the question. You know, I did work in the Sitka Police Department at the time. The police department over in Sitka, I believe we were 22 officers fully sworn. It was no small village police department over there. I guess my perspective on this is that not just out in the villages that they're having difficulty, but we're having difficulty all over the state of Alaska from all the way up north, all the way to down towards Ketchikan as far as filling positions for qualified applicants, and we're seeing that difficulty even in urban areas of Alaska. But with that being said, I think how we grow our own is that, you know, we put programs at very young ages in schools on them considering and thinking about going in our profession. That's one thing that we do here in Juneau. We don't hit them at the very young age, but we do hit them at the high school where we are talking to them on their career day as far as it goes and putting out the idea that maybe they want to join the profession in law enforcement. And I know that there are smaller pools in the smaller villages and whatnot, but maybe on the onset trying to get that into maybe a school district where that this is a possibility for them to serve in their community.
Great. Thank you, Mr. Chairman.
Thank you, Senator Kawasaki and Chief Mercer. Any other questions from committee members? Well, I will just say that you certainly have an extensive law enforcement career there in Southeast and experience, and it looks like you have everything you need to serve the council well. Thank you for your dedication to law enforcement. We are going to move on now. Next, we have Chief Joseph White. Chief White, are you with us? If so, could you please put yourself on the record and tell us about yourself and how it relates to this position?
Sure. Good afternoon. I'm Chief Joe White down in Ketchikan. Thank you, Chair and members of the committee, for giving me this opportunity. I'll give you just a quick background on myself. I was born and raised in Alaska. I attended high school in here in Ketchikan and later in Kodiak, and attended college in Fairbanks and later graduated out of Anchorage. I started my law enforcement career in 1996 with the Ketchikan Police Department, and over the last 23 years, worked my way up through the ranks to become chief. I took over that position about 3 years ago. I attended the National Academy, the FBI National Academy, in 2013. Like Chief Mercer, thousands of hours of training, all the way from simple investigations up to labor law at the academy. So I always try to educate myself and learn something new and take on new challenges when it comes to that. I serve as our chair of our local emergency planning committee here in Ketchikan. I was appointed to APSC back in May of 2018, so I've been through a few meetings, and I have a good understanding of the work that we're doing and the work that continues to be done. I believe that this board, this governing board for the police standards, is one of the most important in the state. When we're hiring officers statewide, the level of public trust has to be untouched. I mean, we have to be beyond reproach with the public. Once we lose that public trust, it makes our job so much more difficult to provide policing services to our communities. So I think that this committee setting the standards for our state is critical. I think the individual departments, you know, they set their own standards that we need to enforce also as local agencies, but we need to be following the whole state as a whole. And at this point, I guess if you have any questions, I'd be free to answer.
Thank you, Chief White. Do we have any questions? Same question. Senator Kawasaki.
No, go ahead, Senator Kawasaki.
Okay, thank you. Thank you, Mr. Chairman. Thank you, Chief White, for being online and wanting to serve on this important board, or council, rather. And I'll just ask the same question of every member who's there. But we're dealing with legislation here that would raise the standards for village police officers and village public safety officers so that they're more in line with deputized troopers and peace officers. And we changed the definition of peace officers. My question to you is, how can we appropriately raise the standards to an important level, but also ensure that rural Alaska maintains its police presence, especially in small places where there may not be a large enough pool that want to live in the region to become police officers.
No, I think, thank you, Senator, thank you. I think that it's critically important that we have higher standards for BPSOs and police officers, troopers statewide. And it's a fine line to raise those standards to the level we need to have good, competent law enforcement officers and still be able to provide the services to the smaller villages. It's a very difficult task. And like Chief Mercer said, we here in Ketchikan, we're finding the same issues trying to get good applicants for these jobs. We currently have two openings, and they're tough to fill. So I think you really need to balance it out. But if you, as I said before, if you don't have the high standard that we set, it's easy to abuse these powers, and once you do that, you lose community trust. So I don't know. We do the same type of thing down here. We hit our high school kids up. We bring them into the station. We give them ride-alongs. We give them tours, and we really do promote law enforcement as a career. And we do have quite a bit of success after kids graduate down the road. We get quite a few local kids coming back, and so I don't know how to incorporate that necessarily in the villages, but I think that that's the age, junior high and high school. We have a school resource officer program that has turned out good results for us in recruiting locally.
Great. Thank you, Mr. Chair.
Thank you, Chief White. Senator Coghill.
First of all, I appreciate the effort that you've put into some of your youngsters in your communities, and that's probably going to go along with almost every police officer there. They're doing their best. Since you have been in some of the meetings, I guess probably for us maybe to understand, the Police Standards Council certainly is going to be holding up the standards, but there's a reactive and a proactive side, if I understand correctly. Can you help us understand from your perspective, it's reactive on complaints, but is there a proactive side that you might say reach out to a department and say, this practice could be improved. Is there a proactive side to that, Mr. White?
Thank you, Senator. Thank you for the question. I think that if chiefs around the state are looking to maybe enhance their standard, their hiring practices, by all means they can reach out to APSC and get, I would call it proactive advice at that point. So make sure that they have their hiring standards they need, the criteria they're looking for. One of the things that we do right off the bat when we're starting to do a hiring process is we'll get that name and run it through APSC right away before we even start the process, because APSC has a lot of information, and sometimes it's good to know the people we're looking at and make sure that they haven't had problems in the state that we didn't know about. Something that happened in Fairbanks, we might not have heard about down in Ketchikan. So I think proactively we're trying to raise the standards. We're trying to help educate the departments. Our meetings are public, and I know chiefs around the state either call in or sit in person and are privy to that information. The reactive side, of course, is once we get the complaints come to us, the cases get looked at and judged over, and we make some decisions that are usually difficult decisions. But again, they're very important decisions. Like I said, the wrong person can really tarnish the whole reputation for not only your community, but for the state. So I think that it's a good balance between both proactive and reactive.
Thank you. I just I appreciate that. Thank you, Mr. Chairman. I just think for us, we need to hear that there's the two sides to that council. Thank you. Appreciate it.
Thank you.
Thank you, Chief White. Any other questions, comments? We also appreciate your service and your willingness to serve on this board, Chief White. Thank you very much for your testimony.
Thank you.
We will now move on to Ms. Jennifer Winkleman, Acting Deputy Commissioner, Deputy Commissioner Winkleman of the Department of Corrections from Juneau. Please come forward, put yourself on the record. Welcome back to this committee, Ms. Winkleman. Deputy Commissioner Winkleman, excuse me.
Thank you, Chair and members of the committee. For the record, my name is Jennifer Winkleman. I am currently the Acting Deputy Commissioner for the Department of Corrections. When not acting in this role, I am the Director of Pretrial Probation and Parole. I thank you guys for your time this afternoon for my reappointment to the Correctional Administrative Officer position on the Alaska Police Standards Council. For the record, I will provide a brief personal introduction. I am a fourth-generation Alaskan. I was born and raised in Fairbanks. My family relocated to Juneau in 2016 following my promotion with the Department of Corrections. I graduated from the University of Alaska Fairbanks with a degree in Justice and Paralegal Studies, and I have been with the Department of Corrections for just shy of 20 years, both in the institution and the field. I love the work that we do. I'm passionate about what we do. I always say it's the best job in the world to be able to influence the well-being of another person. So I am married. My husband, Ron, was also born and raised in Alaska. He retired in 2016 from the Department of Corrections after 30 years with the department. And we have two beautiful sons here in Juneau. So we love to travel, do anything outdoors or with our family. During my previous confirmation, I was asked a couple of questions of why I would like this position, and I thought I would share with you what I had shared then and now with a little bit of experience in the council. I do believe this council is incredibly important to maintain professionalism and integrity in the law enforcement community, and I think this professionalism definitely correlates to public safety. When I was appointed to the Director of Pretrial Probation and Parole, I was presented with the opportunity to serve on this council, and I saw it as an honor and a privilege to serve in a greater capacity outside of my comfort zone of corrections. And I hoped, again, to be able to affect the well-being of others. As a leader in corrections, I have often shared that in order to successfully promote public safety, we can't operate in a silo, and that we need each other and the community's efforts. I recognize that for various reasons, the state of Alaska in general has encountered difficulty with the recruitment and retention, and these difficulties seem to be parallel across all law enforcement agencies. To serve on this council allows me to have insight into the opportunities that can be afforded to produce and maintain highly skilled and trained officers that protect our great state. And on the other side, service on the council allows me the opportunity to help restore faith to those who have lost it towards law enforcement officers when cases of misconduct are brought to our attention. I believe in the work of peace officers, but I also believe it's imperative that there's a check and balance system in place because of the latitude and authority that is granted by the sheer nature of the profession. The other question that I was asked was what value I would bring to the council, and not only can I bring a corrections viewpoint to the council, I think I can also offer a broad statewide perspective. I have managed probation and parole offices from our northernmost office of Barrow, Utagavik, down to our southernmost office of Ketchikan, and the responsibility gave me exposure and knowledge of the strengths and struggles that exist in regard to resources, staffing, and the unique nature of cases in Alaska and how they truly vary from community to community. I have seen and been required to work together with whatever law enforcement agency is in the community, and it is imperative that APSC agencies work together on a daily basis regarding everything from training to day-to-day assistance in the field. Teamwork is imperative to accomplish an independent mission, and I can share that while I've never lived in a community, I have visited countless times, and I bring that experience to the council. I have served on the Alaska Police Standards Council for the last year. The council lives by its mission and core services, and I feel that my experience and personality would continue to be an asset to the council. Over the years, I have listened and empathized wholeheartedly with both the challenges and opportunities that staff face in different areas of the state. I've been fair and impartial in making decisions that impact officers and communities, and I can consider facts and successfully formulate decisions based on the big picture and ultimately the safety of our community. In closing, I would state that while the career field is evolving with technology and tools of the trade, one thing remains steady, and that is the necessity to ensure that the state of Alaska is producing the highly skilled law enforcement agents with morals and integrity. I believe this council is in place to do just that, and I know my statewide experience within corrections brings value to the council and ultimately the state. And I thank you for your time today, and if you have any questions, I'd be glad to answer them.
Thank you, Deputy Commissioner and Director Winkleman. We appreciate that. Any comments or questions from the committee? Senator Coghill.
What's the time frame? You've got a lot of things going on in your life. What is the time frame required for this council? The time that you'll take from other duties to do the council?
Through the chair to Senator Coghill, thank you for the question. Typically, we have quarterly meetings, And then most of it is done via email. I'm thinking you're meaning time commitment to the council. Most of it is done through at our quarterly meetings, which they are typically a day, sometimes a half a day, and then just through email and phone calls.
So I agree with your qualifications, and I appreciate your focus. Last year, I was thinking, this lady's going to be busy. So now you've had a year to look at it. It's a manageable time frame is what you're saying.
Through the chair to Senator Coghill, yes. Thank you.
Senator Kawasaki.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. And I guess for the record, I just have to state that we went to school together, high school years, and who'd have thought she'd be in law enforcement? I'm just kidding. No, I'm just kidding, actually. She was a better student than I was, for the record, and probably never got in trouble. So I think she's a great pick. I'm going to ask you the same question that I asked the previous folks. We're looking at legislation dealing with increasing the police standards for public village police officers and VPSOs to a level that rises to the police standards. And I just wanted to hear your thoughts and feelings about how we work with communities with very, very small populations, probably very, very few applicants, but ensure that they have law enforcement present that does rise to that standard.
Through the chair to Senator Kawasaki, thank you for the kind words. In answer to your question, I know we're not here for those bills today, but it's my understanding that the bills are not actually raising the standards. It's codifying language from the regulations into statute. And so with that being said, I believe that it's an overall strategy essentially to support and improve law enforcement in our rural communities. Basically to discourage hiring unqualified folks, but encourage increased reporting with folks out in the community. But I kind of go back, actually, I was thinking about the question Senator Coghill had asked earlier in regards to sort of the retention, and it goes hand in hand with folks in the rural communities and having a smaller pool of folks to pick from. And I think that the Police Standards Councils, particularly being in place to really be looking at training opportunities and educational opportunities that really educating folks on opportunities that are out in our rural communities, but also making sure that folks are trained when they're going out there, if they're coming from urban areas, that they are educated on what exists out in the rural communities as far as resources and such. So,
great. Thank you. Thank you, Mr. Chairman.
Thank you. Senator Coghill.
If I could just ask you one thing.
Absolutely.
And I appreciate it. You probably have a different perspective having worked in the corrections world. And one of the things that it looks to me like that is a constant is, like you say, the education and those types of things. But from the Police Standards Councils, you're going to see how that works and kind of the toughest of circumstances. From the discussion you've had with those in the council, are there investments that we could do better on that, or is it now just dealing with the shortage of people and getting that investment to the right place? So maybe you can see that from a different level now than you say would as a hiring person.
Through the chair to Senator Coghill, I think the council brings a lot of opportunities with regard to retention and or training that would hopefully lend itself towards retention. And I think that it's really my hope from working with folks on the council that we are looking at the struggles in all communities so that we are getting folks in that are trained and educated and then stay and are supported by the council and others.
Just to comment.
Follow up.
First of all, thank you for being willing to do this. The reason I'm asking that question is we not only look at your qualifications, but we're trying to see through your eyes what we can see better. And that was the reason for the question. we try to figure out where is our best investment, and certainly police departments do that. You at the corrections are doing that, and then seeing how it plays out in the role of integrity and where those lapses are. I thought maybe it's just something you might want to keep an eye on, because we get to look through your eyes into that world, basically.
Through the chair to Senator Coghill, and I thank you for that. And when you just stated the through my eyes, I think one area, particularly through corrections, and I hope that we can incorporate it in through the Police Standards Council, are the reentry coalitions that are in communities, so that we do realize that we are a big group of people supporting folks in different communities, whether that's the law enforcement or the returning citizens.
Thank you, Senator Coghill. Any other comments or questions? Well, thank you, Deputy Commissioner and Director Winkleman. One thing before you go, though, if we could get thank you for your service, over 19 years of service. If we could get an updated resume, I noticed that your commissioner position is not on there, and if we could get that, we'd like to forward that along with your nomination. Thank you very much for your testimony. Next, we are going to move on to we're going to move on to Mr. Weatherly. Mr. Weatherly, are you online? Can you hear us? If so, could you please put yourself on the record and let me know if I missed a title here, and let us know about yourself and how you relate to this position. Mr. Weatherly?
Maybe on mute.
We can't hear you, Mr. Weatherly. If you're speaking, could you check your mute button? One more time, Mr. Weatherly, we're not able to hear you. Brief at ease. All right, we're back on the record. We're going to try one more time with Mr. Weatherly. Mr. Weatherly, are you there? If so, please put yourself on the record and tell us about yourself and how it relates to this position.
Okay, can you hear me now?
Sir? There you are. Yes, sir.
Well, good afternoon. Thank you. First name is Dan or Daniel. Last name is Weatherly, Weatherly. Thank you for entertaining my call in and my comments today. I was born in Iowa and traveled extensively, at least during that time period. Moved from Iowa to South Carolina to Alabama. Georgia, France for 3 years, back to Iowa. Then I went to California and finally ended up in Alaska. In the fall of 1970 with the Coast Guard, I joined the state troopers in 1974, being stationed in Sitka, Anchorage, Valdez, Anchorage, Kotzebue, and finally Homer. And we've lived in the Anchor Point area since 1982. I became the post supervisor upon going to Kotzebue and then being transferred to Homer. Been involved with the VPSO program from its inception to my retirement in 96. I retired in 96 and then did a contract work job with the Homer Police Department in patrol and on the trooper jail contract. I left there in 2000 and went up and worked on the North Slope with ConocoPhillips at the Alpine oil field and basically running a mini flight service weather station-like facility for the airport. At Alpine, I was also on their fire department as an operator driver and on the spill response team. And then since 2015, I've been spending time at our home here in Anchor Point doing a little traveling. I have approximately asked us for 3,000 hours of police training, 105 hours of college credit. One of the questions I was asked there, I believe it was asked, was on the importance of the Alaska Police Standards Council. I think it comes down to three words myself, standards, training to those standards, and then professionalism and maintaining the standards. Certainly open to any questions or comments that the committee may have.
Thank you, Mr. Weatherly. Committee member questions, comments? Senator Kawasaki.
Thank you, Mr. Weatherly, for being online today and for putting your name forward for the Police Standards Council. I was just noticing your employment history, starting with a golf course groundskeeper in France, and nursery work, gardening work in Iowa, and then joining the Coast Guard, the volunteering at the Ketchikan Fire Department, working in as a ranger. This is a pretty comprehensive employment history. I did have a question on just the employment history part. It says you were a state trooper with duty assignments in Sitka, Anchorage Valdez, Anchorage Kotzebue, and Homer. And it says during that same period of time, you were at the Kotzebue Volunteer Fire Department. And I just wanted you to clarify that.
I may have my dates. I was in Kotzebue from 1978 to 1982. And I was with the Volunteer Fire Department in Kotzebue when I was stationed there.
Well, thank you, Mr. Chairman. And it says that those are the dates, and I was just curious if you were working as a volunteer, and I think that's really great, great of you to do. I had a question, and especially I'm interested because of your VPSO experience and the fact that you were part of that when the VPSOs first came to be. You know, we've had a lot of, I don't know if it's called controversy or something else, about just how public safety is dealt with in rural Alaska. We have a system of course, state troopers and village police officers and village public safety officers. I asked a question earlier about raising the standards, and I think everybody's answered very similarly. I'm curious to just hear your background on ways that we could improve law enforcement in rural Alaska, either through the VPSO program or enhanced trooper presence.
I've been familiar with troopers that have...
We lose them. Okay. Brief it. Well, we'll just say, have we heard enough from Mr. Weatherly, or would folks like to hold this to hear more?
Mr. Chairman, I suggest that we'll see if he can reconnect. We'll let him finish his statement and then move on to the next bill. But I think if you want to take any of these and see if he can reconnect, it'll probably only take a minute or so. But if not, we can just put on the record that we'll have him finish his statement. We'll take up another piece of business and then
I agree.
Work him in.
We will take a brief at ease for just a minute. All right, we're back on the record. Mr. Weatherly, are you there? Please continue.
Okay, the Village Police Officer Program was the forerunner to the Village Public Safety Officer Program. The idea was to better train people from the individual villages to work in their communities, give them better training, better support, more professionalism. And I think we did that to a large extent. Now, please understand some of my answers are going to be time-dated because I've been away from the program now for a year or two. But from what my conversations have been just recently with people who are still doing the job, the problems are still the same. The big problem is that there's little little backup and little time for someone to get away from the job of being a VPSO. We had envisioned being able to transfer VPSOs around from village to village, much like state troopers are transferred around. And that program just never, ever got off the ground to any extent. There were several people that were that did transfer to different villages, and it worked out very well. Then we came along with the Alaska Constable Program, which was a now is no longer in existence, but it was a step between a village public safety officer program and becoming a state trooper. And the difference at that time was a state trooper was subject to transfer, and a state constable was not subject to transfer. And that individual was going to be the person in the region that provided stability for the VPSO program, the VPSOs, and interrelating with the community and with the state. Somebody that would always be there that was a familiar face and a familiar personality. I think a lot of the problems with the program is economic. I understand there's been quite a few cutbacks into the program. There's not been any, or not many advancements as far as benefits, monetary benefits, educational benefits, paid leave benefits. And some of that, of course, I know has to do with the particular Native corporation that the individual is working for. The other is that it's just being a police officer in a very small village from where you are from is a very difficult task. And you often end up being an isolated individual within the community. You're the one out there day in and day out because you're on call 24/7. And you're arresting your friends, you're arresting your neighbors, and you're arresting your fellow community members. It's a very tough job. It's, in many ways, it's tougher than being a state trooper, because we fly in, do a job, and then leave. That was one of the proactive things I think I and the other troopers in the Kotzebue region, Nana region, tried to do, is that when we would visit a village, we would... And when we were done working for the day, we didn't fly back immediately to Kotzebue. We tried to spend a day or two and just walk around the village in the evening and make a presence known and speak to people and try to provide some stability and some recognition and someone different who just comes in and stays for a little bit and then leaves. The villages are inundated with government agencies, both state and federal, that come in and want to have a village meeting about a certain subject. And the people in the village just get really tired of it. It's nothing ever really changes, but we have all these meetings. I don't have an easy answer for you on that. I have a friend who is a retired state trooper and is doing census work right now, just got back from ATCA. Took him well over a week to get there, and he was there for a week and then came back. 10 years ago, the population of ATCA was around 95, 96, 97, and today it's 50. And the reason it's 50 is because there's no opportunities for young people and even middle-aged people to maintain a lifestyle.
Thank you, Mr. Weatherly. Any other questions?
There you are. Okay.
Yeah. Any other questions from committee?
Report.
Yes. Follow up.
Do you happen to have a son by the same last name?
Yes, sir. I do.
Who's a firefighter up in Fairbanks?
He is. Yes. Okay. He speaks very highly of you.
I thought you might be the Dan Weatherly when I saw the name. Thank you very much, Mr. Weatherly.
And that's a could I have just a moment?
Sure. Yes, sure. Go ahead, sir.
You mentioned he's with the university and does a lot of training with the students, sir. And he brought up the point that he it's very interesting to sit around and listening to the, well, it used to be the millennial group. I think it's called the X generation now. I'm not sure. People come up and get in the firefighter program and law enforcement program at UAS because those two programs are very well regarded by fire departments and police departments in the Pacific Northwest all the way down to California. Because they're getting educated, they are exposed to real-life experiences of EMS calls, fire calls. And that's not necessarily true down in the lower 48. But they have no intention of staying because of the economic situation and because of retirement and benefits. And so they have what they call the I-5 corridor. And in the evening, these young students sit down and they go over to the fire departments and to the EMS departments that are offering jobs all the way down the I-5 corridor to California. And they compare the salaries, they compare the benefits, working conditions, living conditions, and education conditions that are along the I-5 corridor. So these are very politically attuned and practical individuals that are coming out. They're coming to Alaska. They get well-educated, and then they leave because the opportunities are just simply better from Bellingham, Washington to Monterey, California. And they exchange information on different cities and who's hiring and who's not. And he says it's just absolutely fascinating to listen to them talk and how well-researched they have done each one of these departments over this large geographical area. So we're dealing with the younger group of people that are certainly much more aware of their surroundings and aware of where they're going and what they're doing than I was at that college age. So it certainly is a challenge. And I, stepping out here a little bit, excuse me, but I don't think the problem in Alaska is going to get resolved until we decide what the role of the state troopers are in the state of Alaska and how we're going to extend that out to the cities or to the village. The North Slope Borough Police Department, they had to go to a rotation schedule, like most of the slope workers have. They're in a village for 2 weeks, and then they're off for 2 weeks. And when they're off for 2 weeks, they don't live in the village. They live in Fairbanks, Anchorage, somewhat outside in the Seattle area, Pacific Northwest. So it's a very challenging time. Thank you for allowing me to put that in.
Thank you, Mr. Weatherly. And we do have to move on. We have other pieces of legislation, but very much thank you for your dedication to law enforcement and everything from the Eiffel Tower to Iowa to Alaska. You have an amazing, diverse resume, and so we very much appreciate your willingness to serve. Thank you very much for your testimony, sir.
Thank you for your time, sir, and if I can answer anything else, just let me know at a later date.
Thank you. We appreciate you. All right. We're going to open up public testimony on our nominees is now open. Is there anyone in the room that would like to testify? Seeing none, there is no one online and nobody on the phone who wishes to testify. We're going to close public testimony. Public testimony is now closed. If there are no further questions or comments at this point, we'll take a brief at ease and pass around the signing sheet for the records, which reads, in accordance with AS 3905080, the Senate State Affairs Committee reviewed the following and recommends the appointment be forwarded to a joint session for consideration to the Alaska Police Standards Council. Ed Mercer of Juneau, Joseph White of Ketchikan, Jennifer Winkleman of Juneau, Daniel Weatherly of Anchor Point. This does not reflect an intent by any of the members to vote for or against the confirmation of the individuals during any further sessions. Brief at ease. All right, we are back on the record. Up next is SB 169, an act relating to special requests registration plate celebrating the arts and relating to the Alaska State Council on the Arts. I'd like to invite Senator Stevens and his aide, Mr. Tim Lampkin, to come forward and put yourselves on the record and tell us about the bill. Maybe walk us through the sectional analysis. Welcome, Senator.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. Senator Gary Stevens, Kodiak. I appreciate the chance of appearing before the State Affairs Committee. I was just thinking in the back that I chaired this committee 2 decades ago, so it's good to be here with you. And it's good to be representing the bill that has to do with the Alaska State Council on the Arts. It's an organization I've always admired and respected for the work they do throughout Alaska. So this bill, Mr. Chairman, came at the request of the council. It's a result of complications that arose last budget cycle that had to do with the budget structure of the Council of the Arts and the process. It's truly a housekeeping measure to give some stability to the Alaska State Council on the Arts. It's not just about license plates. It does not create a new plate. It only amends an existing license plate program to provide the Arts Council with additional revenue from those folks who support them. It also provides the means for possible legal representation from time to time that the Arts Council may need, consistent with what happens in other state agencies. It holds harmless their private funds that they've raised in efforts they've had over the years to raise funds. It holds that harmless from the Executive Budget Act. Tim Lankin from my office is here to present a sectional analysis, should you wish that. And also, I understand the Arts Council folks, representatives, are online to answer any questions. Thank you, Mr. Chairman.
Thank you, Senator Stevens. Mr. Lampkin, if you wouldn't mind real quick running us through sections, please, sir.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. For the record, my name is Tim Lampkin, staff to Senator Stevens and the Senate Education Committee. Before you is Senate Bill 169, version U. First, I'd like to point out that two of your members on this committee recently heard and passed this bill from the Senate Education Committee, so they are fairly well acquainted with it already. I'll point out that there were two changes in the bill that you see in front of you, and as I go through the current section, I'll point those changes out that were made. In Section 1, AS 2810421A relates to fees that are collected by Division of Motor Vehicles, DMV, for license plates. Currently, in your packet, there is quite a large list of plates that are available to the public for purchase, supporting a variety of organizations in our state, one of which is the Alaska State Council on the Arts. And the $30 fee is collected, and this provision would allow for them to change that to allow the ASCA to collect an additional surcharge that would go directly to the Arts Council. And my understanding that fee is currently proposed to be about $3, but this provision would allow them to increase that up to $50. That's just sort of a long-term projection of what they could collect if they chose to. That would be driven, of course, by market demand. Section 2, AS 4427, relates to the general provisions and duties of the Arts Council and provides for them to have legal counsel on occasion from time to time. This, of course, is arose from our last budget cycle, and it's consistent with other state agencies in our state that they be provided, as the need arises, a counsel, and that counsel would be provided by the Department of Law, Attorney General. The change here, by the way, those provisions are, there's a handful of them in current statute that have been around since the early 70s. It's not entirely unheard of for this to occur. But the change that occurred in the Senate Education Committee was that we added, first of all, the Department of Law requested that such representation be subject to the approval of the Attorney General. And so that was considered to be perhaps a little eviscerating insofar as if there's a conflict between the administration and the Arts Council, politically, why would that Department of Law choose to approve to represent the interests of the Arts Council? So, and here we agreed with the Department of Law's request that approval, that representation be approved, but that it not be unreasonably withheld, and that's common contract law language. Section 3, AS 4427055D, relates to the Arts Council's managing its general affairs, and it exempts its budget from the Executive Budget Act, in particular regard to its considerable efforts to raise private funds to support the Arts Council. And so this would hold harmless those funds that are raised privately to support the Arts Council, essentially that those funds can't be vetoed. Section 4, 4427080A, relates to a competition that's been on the books for some time regarding who designs the artistic plates. They change periodically, every 4 years, in fact. And so rather than it being mandatory that they have this competition, which was currently on the books, it would give them and make it optional for them to do that. Section 5 is 4427080C, also relating to this competition to recognize the artist that wins this design competition to give the option for them to reward that artist a certain amount of money as they would determine. And again, this provision was repealed in 2018, and this would put it back on the books to give them that option to recognize the artist. And then finally, Section 6 is the second thing that we added in the Senate Education Committee, and that's at their request, an effective date of July 1st, 2020. Mr. Chairman, that concludes the sectional analysis of the bill.
Thank you, Mr. Lampkin. Any questions from committee members at this point? Yes, Senator Wilson.
Yes, thank you, Senator Stevens and Mr. Lampkin, for this presentation. On the Arts Council, just a question here on the plates. So the fee would be $3 on top of the $30 fee, or would it just be the complete 30, whatever the Arts Council seems? So the DMV still collect the $30, then anything above their initial price of their plate of $30, then it would go to the Arts Council? I just want to clarify that.
Through the Chair, Senator Wilson, correct. Currently, the $30 is the fee collected by DMV. It goes to the general fund. The $3 would be the surcharge that would be earmarked to go directly to the Arts Council.
Okay. No. Okay. Any questions? Not a follow-up, but a new question.
No, go ahead.
And then in terms of the Arts Council's continual of, let's say they have another contest, instead of the glowing mountains, they pick some polar bear issue. Does that other plate then get retired, or is it always available?
Through the Chair, Senator Wilson, thank you for that question. I have to assume that the plates, there's not a portfolio of plates that are available, that they would retire the old one and only offer the newest one. But I could be mistaken on that and would defer to the Arts Council to confirm that shortly.
And we do have Mr. Benjamin Brown, Chairman of the Alaska Council on the Arts. Mr. Brown, if you're there, maybe you could take a stab at that question. Put yourself on the record, please, sir.
Yes, thank you, Mr. Chairman, Senator Rivak. And to respond to Senator Wilson's question, the idea is that when the four-year period of one plate is over, they won't be retired in the sense that they will come off any cars that they're on, but there will be a new plate out there. So there will not be two plates being issued by DMV at any given time.
Thank you, Mr. Brown. While we have you on the record here, I understand that you had some testimony as well. Maybe you could go ahead with that.
Yes, thank you, Mr. Chairman. Well, we appreciate the Senate State Affairs Committee considering Senate Bill 169 today. As Mr. Lampkin and Senator Stevens very ably described, this is mostly a housekeeping measure. After last year's experience of being shut down for a few months, but then very happily being able to be reopened when our funding had been fully restored by the legislature and not vetoed by the governor in August, we wanted to look for ways to try to make ourselves more self-sustaining. It's not possible to generate the entirety of the required match for the National Endowment for the Arts through earned income. We can't come up with approximately $700,000 through earned income, but we can come up with a meaningful amount, we think, and the most promising way to do that was putting a small surcharge on our already existing artistic license plate program that would not be a disincentive to Alaskans when they are registering their cars or cost prohibitive to those Alaskans. And so, as Mr. Lampkin said, this bill allows the State Council as a public corporation through the Administrative Procedure Act to select an appropriate amount of a surcharge that will generate some meaningful revenue that will be designated general funds. Those will serve to match the federal National Endowment for the Arts money, and they will reduce the amount of undesignated general funds our agency needs to continue operating. And so that's really the most important provision of the bill. I think, Mr. Chairman, most of the committee members, most of the folks there in Juneau have seen these plates on cars, and they're really beautiful. They were designed by a young woman from Palmer who was a student at the University of Alaska Anchorage. And this is really a great opportunity to both encourage visual arts in Alaska and celebrate things like the Northern Lights and the beauty that Alaska has to offer, but also provide a meaningful source of revenue for a state agency at a time when all state agencies are trying to tighten their belts and find ways to be more fiscally sustainable. So that provision, I think, I hope is to the liking of all the members of the State Affairs Committee. Beyond that, Mr. Chairman, I think Mr. Lampkin did a very able job describing the other provisions of the bill, dealing with the ability to make sure we know the Attorney General serves as counsel, that we have in what is very likely to be very rare circumstances, the ability to hire outside counsel and to exempt our foundation funding partners' investments in the arts in Alaska from the Executive Budget Act. The effective date provision that was added by the Senate Education Committee at our request was meant to make sure that if we're able to start collecting this modest surcharge on license plates, it will be done in a manner that doesn't create any undue bookkeeping headaches for the administration, and it would start very cleanly and neatly at the beginning of the next fiscal year. So because I'm on the phone and can't be there in person, I will try even more than I would if I were there to be brief. But Senator Rebeck, Mr. Chairman, that's in a nutshell is what I would say about the bill. But I am, of course, happy to answer questions. And our executive director, Andrea Noble, is also online to be able to do the same thing as well.
Great. Thank you, Mr. Brown. We will keep you online here. And we do have a question from Senator Kawasaki.
Thank you. Thank you, Ben, for being online. I actually had a question just to follow up from Senator Wilson's question on the plate design. You mentioned that after 4 years, if you were to do a new plate, that the other plate would be retired. Is that what I heard?
Mr. Chairman, Senator Kawasaki, by retired, that means that there would be a new stock of plates at DMV offices across the state being issued. But just like a children's trust plate, which I certainly had on some of my cars, my late father, Dr. Brown, was integral in getting that program launched. A lot of people don't want to change their plates. So you can always go in and pay your renewal fee and get a little decal for 2 years that goes in the upper right-hand corner of your plate, and you can keep that plate for as long as you want. But if you want to get a new actual physical piece of metal that's a license plate, you could no longer get the current one once we have new ones out there. Those will be Mr. Chairman, Senator Kawasaki, does that answer your question?
Yes, sir. Thank you, Ben. Thank you, Mr. Chairman. That does clarify. I guess I do have a question, and it's probably more targeted toward either the sponsor or the DMV.
Senator Kawasaki.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. If there were, I don't know how the purchase of license plates work. If they were to purchase 10,000 license plates and they only sell 5,000, what happens to the remaining 5,000 plates? And if you can't answer that, maybe somebody else can.
Mr. Chairman, Senator Kawasaki, that's a good question. I do know that we are in the second run of plates of the current iteration of the Aurora Borealis, the Moon Over the Mountain license plates, because they've been so very popular with Alaskans. So I'm not sure in what numbers they order those, and that would have to be a question answered by DMV, but we would not want to waste any stock like that. And I guess it would make more sense to... I'm not sure. We'll have to talk to DMV about that, because I wouldn't want to waste metal or anyone's time, but we would also want to make sure that once we had a new license plate, pursuant to the statute, that we were introducing the new artist's successful piece of artwork that has gone through a competitive process. But we wouldn't want to leave a whole bunch of things in a room somewhere and waste that investment.
Thank you, Mr. Brown. I believe Mr. Lampkin also has some information to add.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. Tim Lampkin, staff to Senator Stevens. My understanding is that they do keep an inventory of them, but just they have a sense, a very good sense from historical figures as to what the demand is for these plates, and so they will let themselves get so low before they order more. They don't order vast numbers above and beyond what they can reasonably expect that they're going to sell. But on that point, I'd like to ask if DMV is online. They may very well be, and at this time they're not. So we can get back to you specifically to confirm that, but that's, I think, a safe assumption.
Thank you.
Thank you very much, Mr. Lampkin. Yeah, we would appreciate that answer from DMV. Any further questions from committee members? Senator Wilson.
Yes, thank you. I know that this bill is adding sort of a way to honor the winner, but there's no set amount. What's the usual and customary amount that one would receive for winning the license plate?
Through the chair, Senator Wilson, the latest time that award was made to an artist was in the amount of $5,000. That amount is set in regs by the Arts Council. It's their prerogative to decide that amount, and I'm sure Mr. Brown would be happy to confirm that for us.
If I could, I'm fine with that answer through the. I just want to make sure there are some regulations and some guidelines of how that award. It was just an arbitrary number to say this year it's 2,000, 4 years later 10,000, and I'd be upset if, you know, and there's no set guidelines of how those awards are made. So I just want to make sure there's guidelines and regulations.
Thank you, Senator Wilson. And I also noticed that in Section 4, along the lines of the question from Senator Kawasaki, we've changed from the council shall hold these competitions to change the design to the council may. So I think that gives them a little bit of leeway in terms of maybe how much stock they have. Maybe that's a question for Ben. If why was that? Do you know?
Mr. Chairman, yes. After the somewhat traumatic experience last year of not being in existence for a couple of years, we thought the less mandatory language in our enabling statute, the better. We always want to promote arts and culture for all Alaskans. When possible, we want to make sure that the artists who are providing that arts and culture are remunerated. Paying artists is part of our philosophical, you know, reason to exist. But we would not last year, for instance, have wanted to have been under a statutory mandate to do something like this when we were basically trying to survive. So, and Mr. Lampkin, I want to give him credit for this, Mr. Chairman, because he's been a staffer for a very long time, since before I went to law school and ceased being one decades ago. Don't make it a shall when it can be a may, I think, is probably a wise thing to say in the canons of statutory drafting. So that's why that provision is in this bill, because this is an opportunity to revisit our enabling statute and clean things up. But our intent is, of course, and I appreciate Mr. Chairman, Senator Wilson's embracing that idea, that a young person in Alaska who creates something like this ought to be compensated for it, because it's creating art and it's monetizing our operations and helping to decrease our agency's reliance on scarce undesignated general funds. And that's, I think, a goal that everyone in the Capitol today shares.
Thank you, Mr. Brown.
Chairman.
Yes, Senator Stevens.
Just a comment. I appreciate that Mr. Brown's comments. He mistakenly said that his agency ceased to exist for 2 years. I'll chalk that up to dramatic license. He really only meant 2 months that they were out of business.
Mr. Chairman, Senator Stevens, you're correct. Maybe that was the ether on my teleconference line. I apologize.
Thank you for that clarification. Any other committee comments, questions? Well, thank you, Senator Stevens, for bringing this bill, and thank you, Mr. Brown. As you know, I'm a musician, and I had the opportunity to play music with the Creative Forces, which is a program under the umbrella of the Council on the Arts for disabled veterans at J-Bear, and I just had an amazing experience and saw there's some real value there. And so we thank you for all you do, and thanks for bringing this bill. We're gonna open public testimony on SB 169 is now open. Is there anyone in the room who would like to testify? Seeing none, and there are no folks online waiting to testify, we'll close public testimony. Public testimony is now closed. At this time, we're going to go ahead and hold this bill for further consideration. Thank you again to everyone who testified. With that, we will move on to... We're going to have a second hearing on SB 167, an act providing for an aggravating factor at sentencing for contractors, volunteers, and employees of the Department of Corrections, and providing for an effective date. I would like to invite Deputy Commissioner and Director Winkleman and Kelly Howell to please come back up, and please place yourselves on the record. And so last meeting, the committee asked you to provide information related to the scope of the contraband problem involving DOC employees, contractors, and volunteers. And I was hoping you could please walk us through the information that you provided in your memorandum, please.
Great. Thank you, Chair Rivak and members of the committee. For the record, my name is Jen Winkleman. I am currently the Acting Deputy Commissioner for Corrections. I'm thinking what I'll do is touch on the DOC and of the human resource research that we did, and I will turn it over to, also at the table with me is the Special Assistant to the Commissioner, Kelly Howell, for the Department of Public Safety, provided some information with regard to the number of charges for promoting contraband in the first degree. If we want to go through the letter that we provided, I can have Ms. Howell start for the Department of Public Safety's information that we were able to obtain with regard to the charges.
Please do.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman, members of the committee. For the record, my name is Kelly Howell. I'm the Special Assistant to the Commissioner and Legislative Liaison for the Department of Corrections. The response that the Department of Corrections submitted back to the committee included as an attachment, a spreadsheet of charges disposed. This spreadsheet came from the Alaska Public Safety Information Network, which is the state's criminal history repository, and provided a global kind of overview of the number of charges and individuals who were charged with promoting contraband in the first degree, which is the particular offense that is mentioned within this piece of legislation. So the total number of charges since calendar year 2015 through calendar year 2019, there were 388 charges for 320 individuals. So obviously the individuals had, some had multiple charges of that, that same offense. Of those 388 charges, 327 were for controlled substances. So as you recall, for promoting contraband in the first degree, there were three types of contraband that applied, or three types of substances. One was a dangerous instrument or dangerous weapon. The other was any item that was used to could be used to facilitate an escape. And then the third was controlled substances. So of the 388 charges over the past 5 years, 327, or 84%, were for controlled substances. Six of those charges, or 1.5%, were for deadly weapons. And then the rest of those charges, 14%, were unspecified. So they were just charged at the statute level without citing a subsection. And then as far as dispositions of those charges, the vast majority of them were dismissed, 59%. 127 of them resulted in a guilty verdict, and 21 were not prosecuted. But I will note that the number of dismissed charges doesn't necessarily mean that there was no sanction imposed for that particular individual. You know, charges are often pled down, and sometimes there's other agreements made that certainly the Department of Law could speak to. But I did want to point out that just because their charges were dismissed does not mean that the individual did not incur any sanctions for violating the crime, or the law, excuse me.
Thank you, Ms. Howell. We have a question from Senator Wilson.
Yeah, I was just going to ask something similar to that about, it looks like the charges, 1 in 3 is actually convicted. But the disposition of charges, we're missing 8, if my math is correct. I just didn't know if that was...
It may be Senator Wilson through the chair. I will double-check the math. We, I thought we had confirmed that all of the numbers added up, but let me get back to you on that and make sure that I have my numbers correct.
Okay, thank you.
Thank you, Ms. Howell. Senator Coghill.
Thank you. This is very helpful information. And so I think probably for us to see how this fits into the total population of employed persons. So, but the way you have it, it's over a period of years, which makes that number look interesting, tough. But if you could tell me what the employment annually basically is, and I think we could look back through the first part of the spreadsheet and see. You've probably already done this. You see where your tough spots are. But for us, at least to know how much of a job you have, or how hard the job might be.
Like to respond to that, or?
Through the chair, for the record, this is Jen Winkleman, Acting Deputy Commissioner for Corrections. With regard to, if I'm understanding the question correctly, with the number of staff that we have, is that what you're asking?
Mr. Chairman, I'll clarify best I know how. Those that would be charged with this, what is the normal annual workforce, so that we can say how many of that workforce then had been either charged or sentenced? Does that make sense? If you're a corrections officer, if you are 82 of 100, that's a big deal. But if you're 82 of 3,000, that's a different deal. That's what I'm trying to get at.
So through the chair to Senator Coghill, I don't know the answer to that. In going through kind of the second part of our letter, we checked with our human resource department to figure out how many folks had actually been charged with the crime. And we were able to come up since 2012, 2. And that is out of a workforce, I believe, currently a little over 1,000 employees. We don't track the volunteers and contract workers that would have been charged, and that would have taken a much deeper dive through probably hand pulling. But with regard to actual employees that this law would affect, we have two since 2012.
That is what I wanted, because those numbers kind of give a different impression. Yeah. That's why I wanted to bring that forward. So thank you. That's very helpful.
Yes, thank you very much. And just as clarification here, these numbers include the contractors and officers and everybody that has access to the population who's employed, right? These, as far as these charges are related, it's not just officers.
To the chair, the numbers that we received from the Department of Public Safety would include everybody, correct? What we were able to then do from that was talk to our human resource department and find out how many within that were employees of ours were subsequently charged. So without pulling each file one by one, we were able to find out through our human resource department that there were those two.
Thank you. And so between, I just want to make sure I'm reading this right. So between 2015 and 2019, there were 132 guilty verdicts of all three of these. That includes the deadly weapon contraband and controlled substance distribution. Okay.
To the chair, yes. Anybody that had been convicted of promoting contraband in the first degree, so any of those three would fall under that.
Mr. Okay. Chairman, if I may.
Yes.
The spreadsheet that was attached to the response does list out by the degree how many were actually dismissed or were guilty. So for the ones that were charged under one of the subsections, A1, for example, if you read across the spreadsheet, you could see that four of the six charges were guilty. So it does provide more detail. The response just provided a summary of all of that information. So the spreadsheet provides a little bit more lower level detail for you to digest.
Thank you, Ms. Howell. And I'd like the record to reflect that Senator Wilson has other committee other engagements here. It's that time of the year where we're all overlapping. And so he didn't just decide he was done here. He had other important things going on, as many of us do. So,
Mr. Chairman, if I could continue on the spreadsheet.
Yes, Senator Coghill.
So my first question was, how many are employees? And then the next question is, how many are volunteers? And so if you don't have those numbers, probably it'd be even hard to get how many volunteers are coming and going at this point, probably. But it would be interesting to know how many who are convicted. Obviously, it's a much larger number than people who are under contract or employed. So it's just something. Now, for us, what it does is it shows how creative people can be, and maybe how porous our security system is. That's all.
I agree, and I think just given the numbers that this is important legislation to add an aggravator, I was shocked to see that it was 132 guilty verdicts of people that were distributing, I mean, even several deadly weapons, along with a lot of drugs, which is a huge problem.
And Mr. Chairman?
Yes, Senator Coghill.
I don't have to have that information in order to move this bill along. It's just that when we get to the place and it looks like this goes right to the Rules Committee, and I'm not going to have a hearing on it, but it would be nice to have that before it reached the place where we're going to be voting on it. So having dissected those numbers out, my guess is that's going to be coming up as a question.
Could you please provide us with that information?
To the chair, yes. We will do our best to see what we can
even if it's a
come up with.
Thank you. Absolutely, I agree. Yeah, thank you, Ms. Winkle. Any other questions, comments? All right, well, sure.
I'm willing to move it, yeah.
Okay, well, we really appreciate your time, your help with this legislation, your testimony. We are going to open up public testimony now. All right, public testimony is now open on SB 167. Do we have any testifiers in the room? Anyone who would like to testify in the room? Seeing none, we have none online. Do we have any on the phone? All right, seeing no testimony online in the room or on the phone, we'll close public testimony. Public testimony is now closed. I'd like to again thank you, Ms. Winkleman, Ms. Howell. And with that, I'd like to also note that there are three fiscal notes attached to this bill. Department of Public Safety and Department of Law reported zero fiscal notes, and the Department of Corrections has an intermediate note. Brief at ease.
Yeah, this is actually a question. Well, whoever can answer the question under the 375, 1156, 375, the contraband in the first degree. It mentions deadly weapon, something that could be used to facilitate escape or a controlled substance. And I'm just curious, in the graph, how many of, like, a controlled substance seems pretty broad. It seems pretty broad. And I'm just kind of curious if it was somebody that brought, I don't know, is it, it's not drug, it's not like an illicit drug every time. It could be something as minor as, I don't know, like asthma spray or something like that, right? I guess it just goes to the sort of the statistical information that I kind of wanted to know.
Thank you. So do we have, do you know offhand what sort of charges, what drugs that these charges were brought? And could you also please, I guess, to add that on to Senator Kawasaki's question?
So, Senator Kawasaki, through the chair and to the chair, controlled substance does have a specific definition. It is under 1171-900, and those are controlled substances that you would find. So it wouldn't be, for example, contraband like tobacco or things that would be perhaps promoting contraband in the second degree. The first degree is actual controlled substances, which are those that are defined under the controlled substances statutes.
Okay.
Long list.
Yes.
Okay. Thank you, Mr. Chairman. Thank you.
Thank you, Senator Costello.
So my question has to do with whether or not we're capturing, accurately capturing what we want to capture. And I was thinking back to when I first worked for the state, and I actually went into correctional facilities. I was an employee of the state, but not necessarily the Department of Corrections. And so I'm wondering if we want to change it to an employee of the state of Alaska, because I think there might be cases where somebody who's an employee would be in a correctional facility. So I wanted you to comment on that. And then also, why would we not want to capture anyone who's going into the correctional facility by adding the public? Because I'm sure that the inmates there have visitors. And if I'm reading this correctly, a visitor wouldn't necessarily be captured by this language. I'm looking at actually the transmittal letter, and that might be different than the language that's actually in the bill.
So through the chair to Senator Costello, I think to answer the first part of the question, the intent in the bill was to capture those that have been entrusted and have signed essentially an oath of service to be able to come into the facility and have entrusted access to different areas of the facility versus a visitor or somebody who comes in, maybe just like you said, stated a state of Alaska employee. So the idea is that those that are coming in with special access that has signed paperwork that they have been entrusted into that access And I hope that answers your question.
Mr. Chairman, I can add to that a little bit.
Yes, Senator Coghill.
I've been a volunteer in a ministerial where you actually get a card that gives you access, and you go through a series of requirements that you're trained on, and you agree to. And so I think that kind of adds to what you were saying from personal experience, that there's an expectation. Even I think they still check you very well, but that gives you a credibility that wouldn't otherwise be there. Anyway, just for you, Mr. Chairman, to the senator.
Thank you, Senator. Senator Costello.
Oh, but thank you, and thank you, Senator Coghill, for that. So essentially what we're talking about here is the reason aggravators exist. And what I'm hearing is that it's the level of trust of the person who is there, who is in the facility because they are there for a specific job or perhaps a volunteer with the inmates. And so it's just curious to me because, to me, I see all contraband as a problem. And when I was working for the state and had the ability to go into correctional facilities, I remember in one case the superintendent showed me a cabinet with contraband that had been intercepted. And it's really interesting. I mean, Senator Coghill, you talk about creativity. I mean, they had books that had been gouged out the pages so that you can place items in there. So it looks like you're bringing in a book or whatever. So, I mean, the creativity has no limit, right? But I don't know. I was just thinking that, you know, it'll be interesting to see if this bill passes, whether it achieves exactly what we want. It seems that, you know, the story that's in the packet about the employee who was bringing drugs in to inmates was working with a girlfriend of one of the inmates, and so she wouldn't be she wouldn't fall under this aggravator language, whereas the employee would. And so, you know, it's just interesting, and it might be interesting to hear from someone from the Department of Law who can talk about how aggravators are addressed, and, you know, do they act as deterrents? I mean, it sounds to me that the problem here is that this individual just didn't get enough time. I think he got 8 months is what the story said. And perhaps the reason this came about is because there was a desire for him to serve more time, perhaps. I'm not sure what the story is there, but that's just my thoughts on the matter.
Thank you, Senator Costello. And we actually have Casey Schroeder from the Department of Law. I'm not sure if she could take a stab at that or not. Yeah, why don't we do that? Thank you so much for your testimony, and we'd like to invite Ms. Schroeder up. Please put yourself on the record and answer the question.
For the record, Casey Schroeder, Assistant Attorney General for the Criminal Division at the Department of Law. Through the chair, Senator Costello, I think you hit on it. An aggravator is used to enhance a person's sentence. So the crime itself, in this case, promoting contraband in the first degree, covers what is considered the normal range of conduct for that offense. And in the bill, you're carving out individuals who are saying, for policy reasons, yeah, what you did was bad, but because of who you are, it's, for lack of a better term, extra bad. And so you deserve, you're outside the normal range now, and you deserve an enhanced sentence. These aggravators, a lot of aggravators, and this one in particular is one that we would have to prove to a jury beyond a reasonable doubt. And in that case, for procedural purposes, that we would have the trial for the underlying offense, and then we would come back with a verdict, and then we would tell the jury, well, you need to stay just a little bit longer because we need to talk to you about an aggravator. And that's procedurally how that works. I don't know if there's any other questions or anything else I can explain.
Thank you, Ms. Schroeder. Senator Costello?
Just one other question. And maybe you don't know the answer to this, but of all of the individuals going into a correctional facility, are we looking at this and saying that the only people that aren't going to be under the aggravator scenario would be a visitor to the inmate, or, you know, I guess I'm not that familiar with the traffic in and out of a correctional facility, but do we have counselors and things like that, and do they work for the state? I mean, and that's kind of where I'm going with this, is that if we have somebody, I understand volunteers, contractors, and the employees, you know, they're there to, I understand that, but I'm curious if there are others that are under the state purview that might be going in there to counsel or to provide some sort of, I don't know, job counseling. I mean, other people that we might not be capturing with this particular list. I'm just throwing that out there.
Through the chair, Senator Costello, it is entirely possible that an inmate may have a visitor who may be under the state umbrella in some capacity that is not listed out in this particular aggravator. How often that happens and what the actual purpose is, I don't know. The Department of Corrections may be able to answer that. Anybody that's not listed in this particular aggravator would not be captured by the aggravator.
Senator Coghill.
I can think of a couple of examples. We do have behavioral health people coming and going, and we do have teachers coming and going on a pretty regular basis. And I don't know if they would be considered volunteers or employees, but my guess is they're going to be volunteers because they would be coming in to deal with a specific issue. So maybe that's something we can ask the Department of Corrections, because I do know those two are probably the biggest traffic coming in and out of the doors. Maybe we could have the department.
Absolutely. Could we, maybe somebody from DOC could join Schroeder.
Again, for the record, my name is Jen Winkleman with Acting Deputy Commissioner for the Department of Corrections. Through the chair to Senator Costello, one of the biggest differences would be where that individual has access within the facility. So, for instance, an attorney that's coming in is going to have there's attorney rooms typically sterile at the beginning of at the front of a facility, essentially, where volunteers, which teachers and treatment providers that are allowed access back into the facility, are going to go through that, the background. They're going to fill out paperwork, and they're going to become an approved volunteer, approved contract worker to have extended access within the facility. So the idea is this is going to, this aggravator would encompass those that have that extended access within the facility.
I have a question. Is there a reason that you're aware of that they didn't include volunteers or other folks in this list? Is there a specific reason?
To the chair, my understanding is it is volunteer.
Oh, right. They are. Okay. Okay. Thank you very much. Any other questions?
I'd like to make a motion to move the bill.
Thank you, Mr. Vice Chairman.
Mr. Chairman, I move that we move the Senate Bill 167, Version A, out of the committee with three accompanying fiscal notes and the individual recommendations.
Brief at ease. All right, we're back on the record. We have a motion on the table. Is there an objection? Seeing no objection, SB 167 moves from the committee to its next committee of referral. We'll take a brief at ease to sign the paperwork. Back on the record, I'd like to note that the next meeting will be held Tuesday, February 25th at 3:30 p.m. We'll hear SJR 14, Constitutional Amendment, Votes Needed for Veto Override, HB 56, Establishing Hmong American Veterans Day, SB 101, March 12th, Ashley Johnson Bar Day, and HB 109, Military Children's School Residency Waiver. And SJR 18, women's suffrage. There will be no meeting on Thursday, February 27th. This meeting is adjourned at 5:16 p.m.